Everybody, I'm Bob McGregor. Welcome to Head to Head, the sports show that gets inside the stories to understand the big picture. Today, is the NCAA protecting student athletes or monetizing them without fair compensation? We'll talk to a legal expert and an economist to better understand why college athletes aren't allowed to profit from their successes. Plus, we know more today about concussions and player safety than ever before. Does that change the way we play contact sports? And if so, how much change is needed? We'll talk to an athletic trainer to help understand just what a concussion is, how they should be treated, and what it means for the future of football, hockey, and even ultimate fighting. And later, we first heard about antibiotic-resistant bacteria through outbreaks in North American hospitals, but now the problem may be spreading. Two Tampa Bay Buccaneers are fighting an MRSA infection right now, and that's led the team to scrub down their training facility. If sports facilities are vulnerable, what about our schools? It's all ahead this afternoon on Head to Head.
I'm Brandon Chase, and this Head to Head Sports Update is brought to you by Prue Sports Management. Texas A&M quarterback Johnny Manziel met with NCAA investigators on Sunday for 6 hours as they tried to determine if he received any benefits for signing sports memorabilia. Several brokers claim to have paid Johnny football for his John Hancock. If he is found to have received said benefits, the Heisman winner could lose his college eligibility. I'm Brandon Chasen. That's your sports update brought to you by Prue Sports Management, representing athletes in the United States and Canada and around the world.
Welcome back to Head to Head. I'm Robert McGregor, your host. And we are talking NCAA and the money trail. Johnny Manziel, he is in the hot seat right now and may end up without college eligibility because of allegations of selling autographs and other memorabilia. Question, I guess, is the NCAA right or wrong in protecting athletes to the extent that they don't want them making any money while they're at college? Now, some of this I understand. It makes sense that you don't want teams interfering at the professional level with guys who are still in college. And that's why I bring up our next guests. Professor Matthew Mitten is a law professor at Marquette University in Wisconsin, director of the National Sports Law Institute. He's authored and co-authored multiple sports law books and articles, including a law review article about commercializing college sports. And also with us is Professor Raymond Sauer, professor and chair of the Department of Economics at Clemson University in South Carolina. And he has also founded the Sports Economist blog. Welcome to both of you.
Good evening.
Pleasure to be here.
So I'll start with you, Professor Mitten. Can you help us out to understand a little bit about what the NCAA is trying to prevent and how it impacts players?
Well, the first thing I would say that the NCAA is actually an association of its member colleges and universities, and they make the rules, and they've come together to produce intercollegiate sports, including football and men's basketball, which are really about the only two sports that generate, you know, that generate more revenues than their costs. So these rules really aren't designed to protect student athletes. They're really more designed to protect the integrity of intercollegiate athletics as the NCAA defines it. So they've said, in order to participate in any intercollegiate sports, you have to be not only a student athlete, but you have to be, quote, an amateur. And the NCAA defines what amateurism means. And they basically say that, well, you can get a scholarship that covers room, board, tuition, and books, and even though that's a substantial economic value, you maintain your amateur status. The other thing they're trying to protect is competitive balance. If schools were allowed to pay student athletes, you know, whatever amount of money they thought they were worth or what it would take to attract them, you'd certainly have competitive balance issues. So those are really the NCAA's justifications for what are commonly referred to as amateurism rules.
So, but Professor Sauer, we get into another area of economics where we talk about supply and demand, and while the students may not be enticed by money, certainly at the coaching level, that does come into play, and we see some coaches who are being paid substantial amounts of money to coach at the college level. Does that change the game in terms of how the money is being allocated and whether or not athletes ought to be able to participate in that?
I think it does change the game. I think amateurism is a reasonable goal for college athletics, but what they've run into in the last few decades, and it's been there to some extent for quite some time before that, but in recent years, the flood of money through broadcast media and so on has really overwhelmed the ability of the NCAA and its member institutions to manage it. And so you know, what you have are the coaches really being the recipients of the largesse from a televised broadcast of college football and college basketball, which are fantastic spectacles. But, you know, there's an element that's pretty fundamental of unfairness there where, you know, part of what they're getting is a result of the limitations on what the athletes can get. So, you know, the root of the problem is the conflict between a reasonable goal of amateurism, which has really helped propel college athletes to and college athletics to where it is in the sports landscape today, and the demand to watch televised sports these days through the multiplicity of networks and channels that you can get on cable and satellite TV has just soared beyond anybody's expectation 20 or 30 years ago. And that conflict is, you know, gives us these problems, which are really quite difficult to manage.
Well, it also makes sense to me that without the players, there wouldn't be any revenue coming from these sports because there wouldn't be any sports happening. So, I mean, certainly the players are driving some of that revenue generation.
History drives it, too. So, you know, we talk about Johnny Manziel of Texas A&M, and, you know, there's some talk of, you know what would the damage to the SEC be if Johnny Manziel was not allowed to play football for Texas A&M right. This year. Well, let's not forget, Texas A&M wasn't even in the SEC before last year, and the SEC has become this, you know, television spectacle for fantastic football, you know, on the backs of the institutions and the players before him, before money was as big a factor as it is today. So, you know, who is deserving of what is a very, very difficult question, really, to address on a moral basis. But, you know, there is, I think there's something wrong when you restrict the pay of players but don't restrict the pay of coaches, and coaches get you know, multi-million-dollar contracts where players get tuition and room and board.
Yeah. Professor Mitten, is there some way to balance this in the sense that you're an amateur, so you can't be paid to be a player, but certainly, you know, if we get back to sort of the old good old-fashioned American capitalism, if your popularity or your strength to draw the attention of fans is such that you can sell some T-shirts or sell an autograph, wouldn't that still make you an amateur but just somebody who is able to capitalize on their successes?
Well, I think what you've described is pretty much the somewhat similar to the Olympic model of sports, where originally you had to be a, quote, amateur in order to participate in the Olympic Games. That was changed in the 1970s. It was broadened to where now professional athletes can participate in the Olympics. So, you know, I think the U.S. Men's basketball team is filled with, you know, NBA superstars. And Olympic athletes can make as much money as they want from endorsements, just like professional athletes are. But, you know, it raises a really difficult question, because if we look at, you know, the pending litigation that's out there, the Ed O'Bannon case, that really has nothing to do with, you know, the NCAA school's agreement that among the, that no school can offer more than the value of a scholarship. That case deals with, well, can student athletes get any economic benefits from third parties, like those who, you know, want them to sign autographs, or those who produce video games, or broadcasters. And, you know, that really presents some really difficult issues, because one of the things is, at least in my mind, college sports are a fundamentally different product than professional sports, because you have student athletes with limited eligibility. They're not represented by agents. They can't unionize. They're only there for, at most, four seasons of eligibility. There's a whole host of things that, that make it different. Now, it's questionable whether if, you know, student athletes, let's say, were able to receive at least the full cost of attendance, which at most schools is another $2,500, $3,000. You know, it looks like the schools in the BCS conferences, you know, they would like to pay that. It's just there's a lot of other schools that couldn't afford it, that play Division I football or basketball. So there are ways that you could do this and preserve what I think is the difference between college and professional sports, and I'm not sure that it's, quote, you know, amateurism is the real distinction these days. But, you know, it's going to be very difficult to ask a group of economically self-interested universities to come up with rules to achieve these objectives or do things, you know, on a fair basis.
Well, I need to take a quick break here, but when I come back, I'd like to speak with you guys a little bit more about what qualifies as amateur versus professional, and where there might be, not necessarily gray area, but room for some kind of a discussion that might keep the NCAA happy, to keep the colleges happy, but also to bring the athletes into the 21st century. We'll talk about that right after the break. Stand by. Welcome back to Head to Head. I'm your host, Bob McGregor. We are talking with Professor Matthew Mitten, law professor at Marquette University, and Professor Raymond Sauer, professor and chair of the Department of Economics, Clemson University. Welcome back, guys. We're talking NCAA football specifically, and when an athlete is no longer an amateur. So help me out, either one of you. Let me know what the definition of amateur is. Or when the definition of amateur gets changed because somebody's making some money off of not the sport, but their popularity?
Well, I think that's a legal question, so I might leave that to Professor Mitten. But
okay.
From a de facto point of view, if you're playing in a revenue sport, college basketball or college football, there is a real element of professionalism that you have to go about on a daily basis through the semester while you're trying to be a student. It's not simple. It's not a cakewalk if you're trying to play for a high-profile basketball or football team. So whether you call it an amateur or call it professional, from an economic point of view, it's a bit semantical. They're pros, but from a legal point of view, you know, I'll let Professor Mitten handle that.
Sure.
Well, if we look at, you know, the dictionary definition of amateurism is, you know, someone who plays a sport for the love of the game, solely for that purpose.
Sure.
And under that, you know, pure, you know, refined definition, there really isn't, you know, maybe at youth sports, you know, up through, you know, but, you know, nowadays, I mean, it's like parents are rushing their kids to, you know, try to get a scholarship, all these sorts of things. So In that sense, it's really tough to say, well, we've got pure amateurism in sports at any level, much less college sports today. And we're really the only country in the world where we draw this distinction, or at least try to draw the distinction between amateur versus professional sports. Amateurism for... Go ahead.
I was going to say, what the origin of that, I understand, is, if I'm not mistaken, is to ensure that the kids aren't drawn by money to drop out of school and go pro.
Or to leave their jobs. I mean, the amateur ideal, you know, pre-exists in modern American college sports. In England in the late 19th century, early 20th century, they tried to adhere to an amateur model for football, rugby, and so on, and there's been tension between a, you know, quasi-amateur model and an out-and-out pro model in rugby, you know, for 50 or more years. So, it, you know, we are unique in the high-profile nature of collegiate, intercollegiate athletics in the United States, but the tension between amateurism and professionalism exists in other places as well.
So, I just see it as a huge step backwards. We're in the 21st century. We have the internet. Kids who are 14 are setting up their own websites. They're selling stuff. For some of these college athletes, there's the potential that they suffer a career-ending injury before they ever make it out of college. So they might spend 3.5 years feeding the college system with revenue because of their play, then being injured and never having the chance to turn pro to make the kind of money they ought to have.
Well, that's the source of the problem, is all this money that's come into the game. You know, I think that you know, we should try and work to preserve a system where college athletes on the football team, and let's not forget, most of the college athletes on the football team don't have the skill to make it to the pros, and the same thing for the basketball team. So, you know, you know, some form of increased stipend or compensation can be worked into the system, but if you take away the element of you know, these athletes playing for their school and replace it with playing for money in a market economy, I think you're really putting the system at risk. And you know, as both of us have mentioned, this is a hugely popular system. Let's wipe it out and replace it with a minor league system. Would it be nearly as popular? You know, more people watch college football games on Saturdays than any other sport in the country. So, you know, something is right about it, but, you know, there are a lot of problems to fix. So I'd want to take a measured approach to solving these monetary issues in NCAA football, and, you know, not... destroy the most popular sport by some measures in America.
Well, yeah, Professor Bitten, you wrote a law review article about commercializing college sports. Is that something that we're on the still in the process of evolving, or is that something that really needs to be examined, discussed, and coming up with some solutions long term?
Well, my thought is there's the fact that college sports are very popular. That's what generates the revenue, particularly football and men's basketball, and that's what makes them commercialized. That's just a normal response to market forces. I don't have any issue with that. The real question in my mind is making sure that the student athletes get the benefit of their bargain. I would not favor a system in which student athletes were paid and college sports became essentially a form of minor league football or basketball. I mean, that would really change what I think is the fundamental nature of college sports, some of the factors I mentioned before. Professor Sauer mentioned, you know, correctly, that there are very, very few college football or basketball players who are going to make it professionally. Even the ones who make it in the NFL, the average career is about 3.5 years, and they're certainly not going to earn enough money during that short period that they're not going to have to work. I would rather see the system change so that student athletes, you know, let's assume that if they're, you know, at least 70% of the way towards their degree, by the time their athletic eligibility is used up, they would get free tuition to finish up their degree, which is going to generate much more revenue, rather than colleges competing against each other and they're, you know, being paid more than the economic value of, you know, the full cost of attendance. Perhaps what we do is take some of the money that is generated and put that in a trust fund, and then as an incentive to graduate, each student athlete that does so might get a pro rata share of that. I think that you're going down a very dangerous slope once we start allowing individual student athletes to capitalize on the economic value of what they contribute. That's going to be very hard to calculate. And then we've basically moved, you know, onto a pro model. And I don't think that, I think the NCAA schools should have, you know, reasonable room to carve out some distinctions, but I don't think that they're going to be able to do it themselves. There's just too much economic self-interest.
So maybe not paying the players, but if the players, and I'm not saying that Manziel did this because it's only an allegation, but if a player does want to sell a football with his signature on it and there's somebody out there willing to buy it, why couldn't he do that?
Well, they do it. They have been doing it for decades. Yeah. And the thing that's new here is we know about it, you know, through iPhones recording
right.
the transactions. So, you know, this is the, you know, part of the problem that we've had to deal with for a long time. When you have the heavy commercial aspect and the revenue that comes from having a winning team, and the root of winning is player talent. Money's going to flow to that player through various ways, and it's really difficult to manage it or stop it. And you know, if you're going to try and preserve some sort of quasi-amateur model for intercollegiate athletics in the modern era, it's really difficult. And all we're looking at here in the Manziel case is the surface of the problem.
Yeah.
You know, there's much more that goes on that we don't know about, in things that the coaches and the athletes and the boosters are doing that are really a problem for the universities. There's a real question of whether the universities are capable of managing it at the individual institutional level, not just at the overall NCAA level. When we think about the NCAA, there are 240 schools in Division I that have to collectively solve this problem. That's you know, really hard to imagine. And then when you think
and those
about
numbers might
institutions
be big,
like Missouri,
also
North Carolina, Tennessee, and the corruption that's manifested itself in recent years at these places around their football teams, you know, it's an incredible challenge for the institutions to manage, and it's because of the importance of winning and having a winning football team to them.
Well, and that may be a lot of colleges and a lot of schools, but it's hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue.
Well, yeah, that's, you know, the problem really is enforcement, because the NCAA says you lose your amateur status if you economically capitalize on your athletic exploits or fame. And anytime you have a rule that's that broad and you have, you know, literally hundreds of millions of dollars generated, and student athletes don't even get the full cost of attendance, and you have a number of football and basketball players coming from very much economically disadvantaged backgrounds, and the temptations that are there, agents, you know, boosters, alumni who are, you know, jubilant at a player who made the winning free throw, scored the winning touchdown. It's just a system that is, you know, bound to have these sorts of issues.
So is an Olympic model a realistic middle ground, or is that just going to open the door up to even more potential abuse?
Well, I think it's a possible middle ground, but if you allow the athletes to profit off their image, off of signing autographs, off of some type of post-match media exposure, you're creating a sort of broader path for the loopholes to come in to pay the players. Would that be a bad thing? It might not be a bad thing. We might be able to live with it.
It's the slippery slope argument, though.
Exactly. There is a slippery slope to it, yeah.
Once you allow third parties, like let's say the local grocery store that wants to have a starting quarterback advertise groceries, then you start going down the line of, well, why not a booster or alumnus of the school? And if they're allowed to do it, how about an agent who might not necessarily have the player's best interest at mind, where they're saying, hey, I'll give you X amount of money now. When you turn pro, I'm going to represent you. I'm going to make some money from that. It's a really, really difficult line to draw. And, again, I think there's just way too much self-interest, economic self-interest among the NCAA member schools to draw the best line. There's probably going to be a need for some sort of external third party. One of the things I've been thinking about is might it be time to have go to a commissioner model where you've got an independent commissioner who's got some sort of best interest authority to draw appropriate lines here. There's some problems with that, but it's a model that's not working of having economically self-interested schools make police and enforce their own rules.
Yeah, it's kind of like the fox being in charge of the hen house. Well, I thank you guys for this. It's not something that's going to be solved easily or soon, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more about it in the future, and I'd love to have you guys back on in the future to talk more about it.
Enjoyed the conversation, Bob. Matt?
Yeah, happy to do it. I'm going to check out your sports economics blog, Professor.
Yeah, I hope you do it.
All right, guys. Thank you very much. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Yep. Good night.
Bye now. Okay. And coming up next on Head to Head, we'll talk about concussions and player safety. You won't want to miss it. Stay tuned.
I'm Brandon Chase, and this head-to-head sports update is brought to you by Pru Sports Management. Washington Redskins quarterback Robert Griffin III says he is 100% healed from his knee surgery. Sort of. In an interview with ESPN Radio, RG3 said he is, quote, not below 100%, as he awaits word from Dr. James Andrews on being cleared to play this season. The call is expected to come this week. I'm Brandon Chase, and that's your sports update brought to you by Pru Sports Management, representing athletes in the United States and Canada and around the world.
Welcome back to Head to Head. I'm your host, Bob McGregor, and I've got David Hedloff on the phone. He's an athletic trainer and blogger with Athletico Physical Therapy. He's also the co-head athletic trainer at Oak Park River Forest High School in Chicago. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Sure, no problem. We're talking a little bit about, earlier we were talking about concussions and player safety, but one of the things that really is remarkable to me as a sports fan is the advances that have been made in sports injury rehabilitation. And I'm thinking specifically of injuries like ankle injuries or Achilles tendon injuries that just a few short years ago would have been career-ending injuries for football and hockey players and basketball players. And now guys are back within a year. Is there something different that's being done with those injuries?
I think the main thing that's going on is that through research we've found that there are ways that we can kind of speed up the rehabilitation process and be a little bit more aggressive with some of these injuries that we used to be pretty conservative with. A long time ago, you know, ACL injuries used to be repaired, and then the patient would be casted for a while, where they would be completely immobile and lose a lot of range of motion and lose a lot of strength from not being able to use the muscles. But, you know, we've learned over time that if we actually kind of work out those muscles and work on the range of motion beforehand, even before surgery, we can actually get a better outcome. And then after surgery, we're typically more aggressive with a lot of these surgeries, where we can gain back range of motion and strength a lot more quickly, and we find that we have much better outcomes when we do that.
And is it also changing at the training level with these players, that we're doing something different with these muscle groups and the tendons and ligaments, so that if there is an injury, the body's better able to respond to it?
Well, yeah, I think, especially professional players are doing some sort of training year round, and, you know, the base strength and power and that they have in their body is just better than what it used to be. You know, I don't think it's any secret that, you know, players today in pretty much any sport are bigger, faster, and stronger than they were, you know, 20, 30 years ago. You know, we're constantly seeing, you know, improvements in speed, improvements in strength. And, yeah, I believe that does have it probably has some sort of bearing on the outcome of a lot of these unfortunate injuries.
Yeah. And when a player is injured, is it about immobilizing the injury, or is it about finding ways to keep the injured area moving?
Well, that's a good question. And, you know, unfortunately, there's no hard, steady, fast rule for every single injury. It's kind of a case-by-case basis. But, you know, a lot of times what we find is, take ankles, for example. After an ankle sprain, it might be necessary to, you know, kind of temporarily, you know, immobilize if there's some bony damage or maybe ligamentous damage. And a lot of times we'll do that by putting someone, say, in what we call a CAM walking boot, which is one of the big black boots that you see people wearing occasionally. And that's kind of a temporary thing just to allow the healing to take place. But what we do a lot of times is get them out of that boot and get them moving a lot sooner than what we used to do.
Okay. Are there still injuries now that can be considered career ending, or are we getting to a point now where, you know, there is still some sports life left in these people after those kinds of injuries?
Well, you know, we're constantly making advances in how we're approaching a lot of these injuries, but I think that there really aren't too many injuries where we can't at least get someone back to a somewhat functional level, everything aside from, massive catastrophic injuries, but everything that used to be career-ending, like you were saying, Achilles tendon ruptures, ACL tears, just really aren't, as big of a factor in ending careers as they used to be.
Well, even, like, I think back, rotator cuff injuries used to be really prominent in football, and you're not hearing of a lot of those injuries anymore. Is that because they're doing something different, or?
Well, like you're saying, we're getting a lot better about how we're approaching, the personal training side of things and the strength and conditioning side of things, where a lot of people are doing, preventative rotator cuff exercises to help prevent these types of injuries, changes in, rules about tackling and everything, could also be a factor there. I think it just comes down to prevention. I think that the strength and conditioning and the prevention exercises put together by the athletic training staff, preseason screenings for injury risks have become a really huge market right now. We're seeing a lot of programs being developed right now to look at players before a season actually begins and identifying where those risk factors would be, and say, you know, in a football player, we might say, hey, you know, your shoulder's lacking some range of motion, or it looks like you're a little bit weak in this certain motion. Why don't we do some exercises and you know, try to work on that, and hopefully we'll, you know, we'll prevent an injury. You know, things like that are becoming more common, and that wasn't something that was really done a lot in the past. You know, I think a lot of kind of general orthopedic screens were done, where we kind of look at you really quick head to toe, make sure that nothing's really, you know, glaringly obvious, but, you know,
or you fit the player, yeah, exactly.
And now, you know, especially with some of these multi-million dollar athletes, you know, we're seeing a lot more care and time being taken to kind of go through and do a little bit more, thorough head to toe, workup.
Yeah. And, you know, I think back a generation ago, there was a real push to, in those exercises and trainings for athletes, amateur and professional, to really work on strengthening neck muscles. And that's really paid off, because you don't see anywhere near the number of neck injuries and even paralysis that you used to see back in the 70s and the early 80s.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that, you know, the prevention plays a role in that. I think also, you know, players being smarter about the game and you know, rule changes about, you know, head-to-head contact and spearing have really, you know, kind of helped us out on that front.
Yeah. Okay, I got two more questions for you. Heat or cold?
It depends, you know, when you're applying them. In general, cold after an injury, or if you're still recovering from one, you know, you usually want to use cold after rehab. And if you're dealing with tight muscles or a lack of range of motion, it's usually a good idea to apply some heat before.
Okay. And if there's swelling, that's when you use the cold as well?
I go with the old Rice model: rest, ice, compression, and elevation. And there's kind of a lot more emphasis put on compression lately. They're all good aspects of injury prevention, but there's a lot of research going into just how effective compression is. So that's something you can overlook.
And how long should you put the ice or the heat on for? Is there a time
limit? Generally, say about 20 minutes is generally good enough for the cold to kind of reach as deep as it's going to go. And then you usually want to wait an hour or two before reapplying. You want to make sure that you have full sensation and you know, a normal temperature in your skin before you do another ice application.
Okay. The other question I have for you, I'm going to ask after the break. Can you stand by?
Yes.
All right. We'll be right back. This is Head to Head. Welcome back. I'm your host, Bob McGregor. I'm talking with David Heidloff, Headloff, athletic trainer and blogger. It is Heidloff?
Yeah, it is Heidloff.
I'm sorry. Athletic trainer and blogger with Athletico Physical Therapy, and also a co-head athletic trainer at Oak Park River Forest High School in Chicago. My last question for you has to do with this MRSA scare, the latest coming out of Tampa Bay, where the Buccaneers training facility was locked down for precautionary reasons after two players, guard Carl Nix and kicker Lawrence Tynes, had staph infections on their feet. And just to be on the safe side, they closed down their training facility to clean it up and make sure that that infection wasn't going anywhere. Can you help us out? We've heard about MRSA in the past. Thought it was basically an issue in hospitals, but what is it, and is it something that can be outside of hospitals?
Yeah, the MRSA stands for methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. We usually refer to it as MRSA for short. And basically what it is it's just a very aggressive staph infection that's becoming a little bit more common, like you were saying, outside of the hospital. The thing that makes MRSA a little bit more scary than your average infection is that it's resistant to quite a few antibiotics. So you have to use some of the stronger, newer antibiotics to take care of an infection once it takes hold.
But this isn't a new bacteria. It's a bacteria that has been strengthened because of inadequate use of prescriptions, isn't it?
Well, there are, you know, a bunch of different factors in the how bacteria evolves. But, yeah, that that would be one of them. Anytime you allow a bacteria to survive, you know, it has a chance of evolving and, you know, becoming more aggressive.
And my understanding is that one of the main ways that that can happen is that when somebody has a prescription for 10 days or 2 weeks of treatment with an antibiotic, you know, they use it for 7 or 8 days and they're seeing results and they think they've got it nipped in the bud, so then they stop taking their medication.
Yeah, and, you know, that's, you're right on that. You always want to follow the doctor's directions and take the medication until it's finished.
So if this started out being a problem in hospitals and now maybe making its way or transitioning out into the community into, in this case, a training facility for sports athletes, does it mean that it could be headed to sports facilities and schools next?
Well, it is something that, you know, we do see at the high school and collegiate level. MRSA is actually a fairly common bacteria. You know, if you grabbed a dozen people off of the street, chances are one or two of them would probably have MRSA somewhere on their skin. You know, and MRSA on the outside of your skin is actually not really a big deal. It's, you know, something you can't really prevent, but it becomes a problem when you have a scrape or a cut or any type of open wound, and then the MRSA gets inside. You know, that's where we see these infections, and you know, and that's where you have to seek medical attention to get the antibiotics.
So what can you do proactively?
Proactively, what you need to do is just keep your wounds clean, keep them covered. You can use antibiotic ointments. Try to avoid sharing any type of toiletries, any bars of soap, razors, towels. For most people, that's not a problem for people sharing those. But sometimes at the high school level, someone forgets a towel, forgets a razor, they'll share. So that's something we try to discourage at the high school level. So keeping the wounds covered, and also just seeking attention as soon as you see anything that doesn't look quite right. If you see any wound that looks, you know, redder, more swollen, that's warm to the touch, anything that's getting progressively worse as opposed to better, you know, that's the time to go see the doc and get a professional opinion on what's going on and maybe get started on a course of antibiotics.
Good advice. Thanks, David. Appreciate you being on the show today.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
All right. No problem. We'll take a look at sports updates one last time with Brandon Chasen.
All right, Bob. Brandon Chasen. This head-to-head sports update is brought to you by Pru Sports Management. Pittsburgh Pirates acquired outfielder Marlon Byrd and catcher John Buck from the New York Mets today as they try to bolster their roster for a postseason run. The Pirates are looking to make the playoffs for the first time in 20 years. In exchange, they sent over infield prospect Dilson Herrera and a player to be named later. I'm Brandon Chasen. That's your sports update brought to you by Pru Sports Management, representing athletes in the United States and Canada and around the world.
And that's it for today's show. My thanks to our guest, Professor Matthew Mitten, law professor at Marquette University in Wisconsin and the director of the National Sports Law Institute, Professor Raymond Sauer, professor and chair of the Department of Economics at Clemson University and founder of the Sports Economist blog, Walt Doc Ganey, athletic trainer at Rock Hill High School in South Carolina, and David Heidloff, athletic trainer and blogger with Athletico Physical Therapy and co-head athletic trainer at Oak Park River Forest High School in Chicago. Thank you all for your contributions, and thank you for listening. This is Head to Head with your host, Bob McGregor, live from BBS Radio in Los Angeles. We're heard on the drive every weekday from 3 to 4 Pacific, 6 to 7 Eastern, and all hours in between. BBSradio.com is available on your smartphone, laptop, and iPad. We're back tomorrow. Have a great night.